You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Donald Trump throws his toys out of his Twitter feed again, this time appearing to threaten the recently fired director of the FBI. My guests, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord, will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Trump's imminent summit with apparent kindred spirit Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the latest from Kiev as Eurovision looms. We'll also hear from our Eurovision desk chief, who is there covering the contest, and finally,
attention in the water. Be advised, State Parks is asking us to make an announcement to let you know you are paddleboarding next to approximately 15 great white sharks.
A marginally less troubling announcement than Eurovision looms, but how calm can anyone issuing such a warning expect the recipients to keep? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests on Midori House today are Monocle 24's executive editor Tom Edwards, Monocle's features editor and former Istanbul bureau chief Chris Lord, and Monocle's Eurovision desk chief Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who will be joining us a little later on. Welcome all. We will start with the by now familiar mix of bewilderment and weariness in Washington, D.C., where the President of the United States has been baiting the recently dismissed director of the FBI on social media, because that's the kind of thing that apparently happens now. In the latest edition to the bulging file of stuff you can't imagine Eisenhower doing, Donald Trump has tweeted that the suddenly unemployed James Comey had better hope that there are no tapes of their private conversations. Tom, Trump put tapes in inverted commas. Is that significant, or is it just Trumpian grammar?
I think that was Trumpian grammar, but alluding to tapes surely is him referring back to the demise of the Nixon White House. Everyone's been writing about it. Even he can't be so oblivious to what's going on.
Do you think Donald Trump's heard of Richard Nixon?
I reckon he's found out about it this week. I'm quite certain he had no prior knowledge given his conduct over the last few days. And it's funny what you said, Andrew, in your introduction about the familiar mix of bewilderment, I think you said.
And weariness.
And weariness. I actually found that this was rather unfamiliar, because this seems different even to some of the excesses of the opening 100 and change days.
I don't know what's normal anymore, is the trouble.
But there's something so profound, and maybe we can come on to this, because there are allusions to 1973 and all of that. This feels like something different, and I don't know. I'm heartened in a strange way by what's happened, because it seems so bad and so ridiculous that I cannot imagine Donald Trump still being in the White House in 3 years' time.
Chris, I was also put in mind of a previous relationship between a president and an FBI director that he found personally troublesome, and this was, of course, Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover. Johnson famously said that he would rather keep Hoover inside the tent pissing out than have him outside the tent pissing in. Is Trump perhaps beginning to realise that Comey may now be in a disadvantageous position for him vis-a-vis the tent?
Well, the ultimate. I can't speak for the tent, but what I can say, I mean, I think, you know, the reality is that now that Comey is technically out of the picture, the reality
and the tent.
And the tent itself, yeah. The reality is now Trump has got, now he's got to look at who he's going to bring in, who's actually going to come into that place. And if you look at the roll call of people who've been put forward for this, I mean, it's pretty worrying stuff.
Is one of them a balloon with a face drawn on it?
One of them is Chris Christie. So.
Well, near enough. Yeah,
I think Trump had a Twitter spat with that balloon with the drawn-on face before, so he's out of contention.
But Tom, Trump himself has appeared to have convincingly, personally unravelled the initial fiction that he was acting on the recommendations of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. That was initially floated in order to give him an apparent bit of cover, saying, well, I was just doing as my top two law officers suggested. Whereas afterwards, he's now said, no, I was going to sack him all along.
Do you know what's interesting, Andrew? A lot of people have also cited a truism about politics, if you like, which is it's not the initial crime, it's the cover-up that's the problem. And what's particularly interesting about this is Trump appears to be unravelling according to that truism, because he's realising that as he picks these fights, his allies become harder to keep track of. He realises that the pool of people he can call upon to be part of his project diminishes. And yet at the same time, beneath all of this bubbling away, the ongoing inquiry, the question about any collusion. What did it look like? Who was aware of it? And it's so serious. And possibly the only reason why this is very different to 1973 is actually the malfeasance potentially that's taken place here. It remains an allegation at the moment. Is incredibly serious. It's far more serious than a botched break-in on your rival's election HQ. We are talking about, allegedly, the involvement of a foreign government.
A hostile foreign government.
You know, those are challenges to, I don't know, the fundamentals of what America is supposed to be all about. But so he's in a position where he is unravelling because of the seeming web of lies, but then there remains bubbling away this offence, which is so appalling. This could knock Watergate into a cocked hat.
But that's if there is any smoke, or sorry, other way around, any fire beneath this smoke. Because Chris, I'm just now going to float my own theory, which is coalescing in my head the more and more the stranger and stupider this whole thing gets. Is it actually possible that Trump is an innocent man entirely, and the reason that he is just flailing and flapping around like this, that basically he is massively out of his depth, isn't all that smart, and doesn't have the faintest idea what he's actually doing?
One of the strangest things this whole week for me, bearing in mind I've come back fairly recently from living in Turkey for Monaco, working there for our bureau there, and seeing the various absurdities that happen in Turkish politics and all that kind of thing. What's been extremely weird to me is that the day or two after this whole thing happened, who strolls into the White House but Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister.
It was literally the day after.
The day after. So you have a scenario where all this is happening, and yet that still happens.
But this is what I mean, because if you are on the hook to the Russians and you sack the FBI director because you're on the hook to the Russians, unless you're a complete simpleton, the thing you don't then do is invite the foreign minister and the ambassador into the Oval Office.
The thing I would say is, before we came on air, we were talking very briefly about this Economist interview that was out this week, and I have to say, I only actually looked at it today.
It is extraordinary.
And it is extraordinary. It was the transcript. I had a quick look through. Tom, you described it as basically like a word cloud, which is sort of like an assemblage of words without any sense or meaning put together into a kind of vacuous collection of syllables, right?
I seem to recall saying that earlier.
That was the quote, you know? But the point I'm getting at is, when you actually read what he's basically saying, it is the problem of our time, of these people who've arrived onto the political scene, is that when they are actually asked to sort of expunge what they're actually talking about, these things that they can say in short sound bites, even this tapes thing, if you actually sort of went and talked to him about it, he would come out with a whole string of nonsensical information. It's the problem of populism, is that when you start to interrogate these people and actually look at what they're saying, they don't really have anything to say.
It is almost like they're charlatans and mountebanks who don't really have the first clue what they're actually doing. Tom, on which subject, we have also seen on Twitter today from inside Donald Trump's head the suggestion, and I'm quoting almost literally, him suggesting that his surrogates can't be expected to be accurate when taking questions from the press because there's just too much going on, and who could possibly be expected to keep track of that, and also that maybe press conferences should be replaced with printed handouts. The second of those may be one of his little jokes. It's increasingly difficult to tell. But what the hell kind of a thing is that even to say?
Well, but you've already suggested, Andrew, I think rather eloquently, certainly entertainingly, we shouldn't be surprised anymore. And something worries me deeply about the fact that he appeared to essentially threaten Comey today via Twitter. The fact that he made
appeared nothing. He explicitly threatened him
on Twitter with this tapes thing. He again essentially threatened the press that he'll withdraw their privileges of actually speaking to anyone from his administration, and they'll get printed handouts. You know, if that happened in a banana republic, you would be surprised at such a sort of brazen challenge. I don't know. I'm kind of partly convinced by what you say, Andrew. It's so slipshod. The approach is so scattergun. It's so lacking in coherence. If he were some sort of Machiavellian, Nixon-esque, you know, eminence grease, manipulating things to his own ends, there would be a more coherent approach, surely, from him. It's so slipshod. It's so erratic. It does seem like he's just making it up as he goes along.
Final thought from you on this one, Chris, before we move on further to that comparison you made yourself between Trump and Erdogan. in taking on the FBI, and I will admit that there is a large ballast of wishful thinking underpinning this question, is it possible that he has kicked a hornet's nest?
I think so. I mean, I think this entire week has been one big hornet's nest after the next of kicking. I mean, as I said, he's
playing football with a hornet's nest.
He's playing football with a hornet's nest, and that this can only go wrong. I mean, there's no way this can go right for him here in many ways.
Well, we can only hope. We will move on slightly, because if Donald Trump can find a sympathetic ear for his beliefs of a vast conspiracy of the media classes, political establishment, security apparatus, and deep state in general plotting to thwart him, it might be one of the ears belonging to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is due to visit the White House on Tuesday. Trump has previously spoken approvingly of Erdogan's recent advances in centralizing the Turkish state in himself. Chris, as you were just saying, you lived and worked for a long time in Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Turkey. A lot of people have drawn the comparison between the two men. Trump's been kind of anxious to sort of lead people to that comparison himself. But again, we run into that comparison, don't we? Tom Reyes Nixon, who for his manifold other deficiencies of character, and he was a dreadful, 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 terrible man, was not a fool. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, there are any number of reservations one might reasonably hold about his rule. But again, he does appear to have some idea of how to do his job, which is to run a government, maybe not the ideal kind, but he doesn't appear utterly incompetent to do the job he's supposed to be doing. What do you imagine is going to go on at this meeting? Is Trump going to ask him for advice?
Maybe. Or maybe even Erdogan's going to ask some advice from Trump. You know, how's he going to reboot things? Because don't forget, Erdogan's going to face a general election next year. And really, it could all go wrong for him. It's nothing set in stone right now, even after that recent referendum. What I think is going to be the top of the table chat the next week is going to be the fact that the US has... Trump has finally made a decision, which has been in his inbox since he came to power. Is the US going to arm the Syrian Kurdish militias in the north of Syria? Are they going to provide them weapons to fight Islamic State? And essentially, are they going to be able to secure that entire region and potentially with the view to forming an autonomous state there in the north of Syria? Now, that's going to be the top of the table. What amazes me this week is actually how, relatively speaking, quiet Erdogan has been. I mean, if they block a minister from doing a rally in Netherlands and he calls them Nazis, the US starts arming a group that they say are terrorists, and Erdogan says, oh, our relations might well be negatively affected. So the point I'm making is that I think what's happening now, there is a case of Erdogan going around the world a little bit cap in hand, because all that stuff that led up to that recent referendum, getting in the argy-bargy with the Germans, with the Dutch, all that stuff was playing to his nationalistic home base. And the damage that has done to Turkey's image, to Turkey's economy, to Turkey's foreign direct investment is massive. And he is going around his world tour is embarked upon as we speak. He is going around cap in hand trying to mend some fences. And Trump, for all his stupidities, announced this thing probably at the best moment, because when Erdogan right now needs some friends.
But this is another difference in character between the two men. Erdogan gets what he wants and then calms down a little bit, whereas Trump, who has spent his entire life getting absolutely what he wanted, shows no inclination of ever being willing to calm down or focus on what the next available thing is. But looking at this from Erdogan's point of view, as you say, he does face a general election next year. His future is not assured. Turkey remains a democracy for the moment, at least. How is Trump seen in Turkey? Because this is a thing that foreign leaders from all over the world are going to have to think about as long as Trump remains in office. The political cost of being seen to be getting too close to Trump, who is not a popular man in most other places. European leaders, for example, are not going to want to be seen to be too cozy with Trump. In Turkey, though, is it going to play? Does the strongman image that Erdogan projects, is it reflected in Trump as well?
I mean, on a very facile level, Trump has investments in Turkey, significant investments in Turkey. He has brought money and work to Turkey. So in that element, you know, it's relatively positive. I think that we have to always remember, of course, Turkey is a majoritatively majority Sunni Muslim nation. So any guy who proposes that some sort of Muslim travel ban and so on that will not be popular. I think also as well, I think I remember some Turkish friends of mine were sort of quite, not pleased, but they were sort of slightly reassured when Trump came to power that it's not just their country that's always in the bad news for insane leaders. So there is that to be said, maybe. I think just to come back a little bit to what you were saying before about, you know, Erdogan calming down and getting what he wants. The fundamental difference between these two men, as it currently stands, and it will change with time as Trump stays in power, is that Erdogan has a lot of skin in the game. In as much as the day that he leaves power is the day he has to go in the courts and defend some of the actions that he's done while he's been in power. Some of the accusations of corruption, of malfeasance, all this kind of thing. Major things that he will one day have to face. Hence why he holds on to power with an iron grip, because he never wants that day to come. For Trump, yes, he has these business interests. He has his reputation. Now, when we start seeing this Comey scenario, he has skin in the game. This is why we're seeing the snake lashing out, as it were.
Tom, since Trump took office, which does seem so very, very much longer than 111 days or whatever it was ago, it has become an international sport, really, dissecting the semiotics of the body language when he meets foreign leaders. What do we expect from Erdogan? How many slaps on the back will they exchange in between the car and the door to the Oval Office? Will Trump try to pull the handshake maneuver on Erdogan? What are we looking for?
Well, this is interesting. I might have given a very different answer just a few months ago. What strikes me about Erdogan is that he's canny enough politically to understand that maybe it's politically expedient for now, you know, to Chris, pick up on your point about a surprisingly muted reaction to the US arming these particular forces. I think he understands that, well, let's get there. Let's meet him. Let's see what he's about. He understands that it could be politically expedient for himself and QED for Turkey to just bide his time, see the meeting. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if Erdogan not permits, but slightly indulges Trump, lets him play the leader, the statesman, and just make sure that he's actually working out how he can profit in the longer term. I think he's shrewd enough, you might say conniving or scheming enough, but I think he's an experienced enough politician, skills that Trump couldn't have, given his lack of having held public office before, to be able to allow himself to be played a little by Trump. I don't think that will trouble him, despite his strongman image, because I think he understands that it could be far more profitable for him to turn things to his own advantage after this first meeting.
Just a final quick thought from you on this, Chris. Has Erdogan and have leaders around the world yet figured out the way of playing Trump? Is there yet a conventional diplomatic wisdom? It strikes me that it might be lavish him with as much praise as you possibly can without being pelted with tomatoes as soon as you step off the plane on your return home.
That would be the Turnbull example. Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a very good question, Andrew. I mean, this week will be in many ways a test of it, because this is not Xi Jinping. This is not the leader of China. This is not, you know, a sort of major, major power like that. Still a very important power. It's not, you know, but it's not quite to China level. You have a leader in Erdogan who is fundamentally represents a shift to autocracy. That's what he has overseen in Turkey, a shift towards something that's no longer democracy. And it will be a worrying case if he can win Trump over.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. After the break, we'll be joined by our Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, live from Kiev.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Yeah. You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. And we can also welcome from Kiev, Monocle's Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, welcome to the show. You had been promising us before you embarked that you would get an interview with the mayor of Kiev and incidentally three-time world heavyweight champion, Vitali Klitschko, and you delivered. So we will come to you shortly. But before we do, let's have a listen to your chat with the mayor.
Ukraine is a European country. Kyiv is a European city. Not everyone knows it's the middle of Europe here in Ukraine. And we actually European people with our history, with our mentality. But we're working right now pretty hard to bring to Ukraine European standards of life. It's very important. And we are very happy to be capital of music, European music, in this week, because it's Eurovision in here in Kyiv is great event, and we're very happy to see so many guests, so many friends who come to Kyiv to listen to music, and someone who doesn't have a chance to be present by himself in Kyiv can see the event in by TV translation, broadcasting in everywhere in the world. So, last Eurovision have public, it's more than 230 million. Amazing numbers.
It is amazing numbers. And let's talk a little bit about your plans for the city during the event. For example, we're here currently at the City Hall. I can see your village is literally in front of the City Hall. That's quite interesting. You're very close to the big, where the fans will be. So tell us a bit about the plans you did for Eurovision this year for the city.
Yes, of course. Our goal, my first job, many know Klitschko as world-famous sportsman. Some people know me as mayor of Kyiv, but not everybody know my first job. All first job, I working as guide. I make excursion for the people. I know my city so well. I know how big touristic potential have our city. And we have a chance right now to invite so many people from around the world to visit to Kyiv. And everybody surprised how beautiful city, European city. It's a city with some special energy. How gas-friendly people live in our city. And that's why, if I see the last year Jamala won Eurovision, I jump so high. I can't believe it's our country, our city will be guest city for many people who come to visit Ukraine, to visit Kyiv, and it's a great event. And our main goal to make every visit very comfortable, and everyone who leave Kyiv live with great positive emotion and good memory about capital of Ukraine.
And fresh from going three rounds with the heavyweight champion of the world, we are joined by our Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, in Kyiv. Fernando, 24 hours and some very minor amount of change away from the final starting. First of all, the second semi-final was last night, I think I'm right in saying. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought again, I really liked the results. Two of my favorites went through. Of course, Israel went through. I think they had a very good performance, quite camp as well, which is quite interesting. Belarus.
Hang on, Fernando, this changes everything. There was a camp performance in Eurovision.
I mean, sometimes there are those. I know they're the exception these days. I'm clearly joking. but again, I think it's a very strong lineup. And if I may dare to say, Andrew, I think it's the best lineup for the last 3 years.
So in that long? So you think it's shaping up as a vintage Eurovision?
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting because I spoke to Christer Bjorkman. He's the show producer. And actually, my interview with him will be on the Monocle Daily later tonight.
Indeed,
and
will.
I think lots of the reasons why Eurovision is going to be fun and good is actually because of him. Because the Ukrainian committee, they decided to bring Christer, a Eurovision legend, to produce the show. Because a lot of people were worried that the Ukrainian event, you know, there were a lot of delays, quite a few problems here and there. But then Christer arrived like 2 months before the show, and everything's been, you know, fairly good here in Kyiv.
I want to bring Tom and Chris in very briefly, in that order. Gentlemen, what would you be doing for Eurovision? Tom?
As Fernando, I'm almost apologetic to say this to Fernando while he's listening, but I'll be trying to probably avoid it as best I can. I would just like to ask Fernando, if your interview with Vitaly Klitschko, Fernando, if it had taken a turn for the worst, do you reckon you could have taken him on? I think he might have shaded the early rounds, but would your underlying fitness have given you the advantage over, say, the full 12 rounds?
Well, Tony, I've been practicing boxing. I mean, it's not a lie. I've been doing this for almost a year. And in fact, I think I could give him a punch or two. I think I'm becoming a slightly more, not aggressive, but more tougher person. I mean, not
Fernando,
tough,
you're still in Kiev. Can we not try to make this happen?
Yes.
Could you not find Mayor Klitschko and spill his pint or something?
I mean, by the way, he's such a lovely guy. I mean, when I went to meet him, he was saying, "Bonjour, monsieur." I think he thought I was French. I love when people think I'm French, but unfortunately, I had to say, "I'm sorry, actually, English, Brazilian, whatever." But he was quite a friendly guy. Massive hands.
Well, they would help in his line of work. Chris, yes. How will you be spending Eurovision?
Oh, I'm on a train, actually. I won't be anywhere near Eurovision, I'm afraid.
It's not one
Andrew.
Of these Eurovision train parties I've been reading about.
I hope not. I really hope not.
You bring the party, though, Chris, so I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
Where you lead, others will follow.
What about you, Fernando? What's your night going to be tonight? Where are you heading?
Well, it's funny because even though I'm press, a lot of people don't know, but journalists actually, they watch the final at the press center because they've seen so many rehearsals, so many semifinals that the final is almost boring for them. But I like to be on the stadium at the final. Of course, I have my ticket with me. And then, of course, I'll dance the whole night at Euroclub where usually the winner performs. And you can always see strange and interesting things there as well.
Fernando, you mentioned there just finally the winner. We doubtless have many, many listeners agog over their betting spreadsheets for Eurovision, wondering where to plunge their stake. Who is going to win?
Well, we're definitely staying Southern Europe because I think it's going to be either Portugal or Italy. Italy is the main favorite, but I've heard from some experts here that I think the Italians are a bit too cocky because, people are very moved by the Portuguese entry by Salvador Sobral.
And I myself was moved by the Portuguese entry quite a way out of the room.
Do you think they can win, Fernando? Do you think the Portuguese can get their first ever Eurovision win? What do you think?
I think they can because, and how can you spot that as well? Because apparently the single is doing very well on the iTunes charts around the world. That's an early sign that a song will do well at the final. I'll be very happy. It'll be the first time the Portugal is going to win. Of course, I speak Portuguese, and I can imagine myself in Lisbon already next year. I'll be king of town. I'm joking, clearly.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco in Kiev, thank you for joining us. Finally tonight on Midori House. Now, if one were to play a parlour game of things you don't want to hear from a helicopter loudhailer while enjoying a day at the beach, this is a plausible winning entry.
Attention in the water. Attention in the water. This is the Orange County Sheriff's Department. Be advised, State Parks is asking us to make an announcement to let you know you are paddleboarding next to approximately 15 great white sharks. They're advising that you exit the water in a calm manner. The sharks are as close as the surf line. Thank you for your cooperation.
It sounds like the sharks were advising them to leave the water the way he says it, but exactly that warning was spake unto the paddleboarders of Capistrano Beach in California yesterday. The voice urging them to leave the water in a swift yet orderly fashion belongs to a deputy from the Orange County Sheriff's Department. I think we're only discussing this because our producer Danny Giacopelli just wanted to put the Jaws theme in the show, but have either of you ever seen a shark for real in its wild natural habitat, as it were?
I once saw a basking shark. In the waters off the British Isles, Andrew. They're one of the big old ones that don't do much. Big mouth open and plankton. They just ease through the water, sifting plankton joylessly. Very much often like reading the British media.
How do you know it's joyless? They might be thoroughly happy with it.
They don't look like
it. Sounds like paddleboarding. Paddleboarding's a bit like that. Gliding slowly through the water joylessly.
Chris, do you have a shark anecdote you can enliven the next 8 seconds with?
To be honest with you, no. The only thing that strikes me about that clip is that he almost definitely should have said, like, "Hey guys, hope you're having a great time. Just to let you know, there's some beers back on the beach. Just go slowly back towards it, very calmly and slowly, rather than be careful the
carrot, carrot rather than stick." You're saying
exactly is what I'm saying.
You think he overemphasized the urgency of the situation?
I mean, nothing makes you panic like "don't panic," does it? Really?
He did. Did he have to say 15 great white sharks? What about just
Hey, there's a couple of white sharks.
A couple of sharks.
A couple of big fish.
That's a bit of a graphic picture, yeah, I thought.
That is all we have time for with that reflective note on today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Darren Graham. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, Marcus Hippie with The Menu. I'll be back with more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.